Probably my all-time favourite video by the YouTube channel Computerphile is a video titled Rabbits, Faces and Hyperspaces, wherein Robert Miles inadvertently and mathematically disproves the nonsense feminist notion of sexist representations in video games. I'd highly suggest watching the video yourself, but as a recap, we understand, categorise and group things based on their various features. Once you have a set of features you want to categorise things by, you can effectively build a feature space and see how certain subjects are grouped based on these similar or differing features. If you're a regular viewer of mine, you're probably aware that I have a bit of an interest in machine learning systems. Not just because AI is cool in its own right, but because when you're trying to design a machine learning system from scratch, you have to go right back to the drawing board and ask some very fundamental questions about the nature of intelligence itself. How do we understand the world? How do our human brains categorize things and then make choices based on those categorizations? To me, machine learning's insights into the human mind are as interesting as its real-world computing applications. For instance, say you wanted to teach a computer to differentiate between men and women. How would you go about doing that? For that matter, how do we differentiate between men and women? I mean, we can look at a very, very simplified drawing and instantly recognize that one of them is supposed to be male and the other one is female. It seems completely intuitive, but our very ability to do this means that there must be a consistent logic underlying that intuition. As a simple example, we could take a hypothetical group of men and women and build a two-dimensional feature space looking at hip-to-waist ratio and muscle mass. There'll be some slight overlap, but generally speaking, men have a higher muscle mass and women have a narrower hip-to-waist ratio. And when we plot them into the feature space, we can see a clear distinction between the two groups based on these features. From here, we can actually start considering the underlying logic of distinguishing men from women. Based on this feature space, we can look at the two groups and determine what the average man and woman looks like. And then we can start assessing people within that group. How far away from the male average is this person? In other words, how typically male are they? Are they big and burly, or are they more androgynous? We can basically draw a line through the two group averages to create a clear, quantified, measured spectrum of male to female based on these feature attributes. And this is where things get kind of interesting. We're often told that Bayonetta is the result of sexist female objectification, and Marcus Fenix is a patriarchal power fantasy. In reality, both of these characters are the exact mathematical outcome that you would logically expect when you exaggerate characters along this vector within the feature space. As you progress along this line in both directions past the point at which normal humans exist, what you end up with is effectively a caricature based on the exaggerated features that differentiate men and women along this gendered spectrum. In the case of Bayonetta, this is uncharacteristically long legs, big boobs, and a narrow hip-to-waist ratio. In the case of Marcus Fenix, that is a huge, bulky stature with oversized hands and bicep muscles and a head that resembles a cinder block. This isn't sexism. This is just the mathematical outcome that you would logically expect from exaggerated caricatures based on the features that actually differentiate real men from real women in the real world. There are real, biological reasons that underpin why exaggerated male and female characters turn out this way. And frankly, if their body types were reversed, our brains would recoil in shock because on a real visceral level, it just looks so wrong to us. In their original forms, they are recognizable. They're exaggerations, but they're exaggerations along a coherent spectrum. Reversing their body types, however, we know this is not what a woman is supposed to look like, and we know this is not what a man is supposed to look like. Now, hip-to-waist ratio and muscle mass are fairly obvious and easily measurable physical features. However, we seem to have a collective tendency to assume that biological differences as a result of evolution only exist below the neck. I've talked about this before in older videos. As a sexually dimorphic species, there are clear and obvious reasons why nobody, not even the hardcore feminists, want to see tennis become a mixed gender sport. But then everyone will look at games like chess and StarCraft and stand around scratching their heads, completely perplexed by the fact that there are almost no women at the upper echelons of these competitions. It was actually funny, a couple of people commented on that old video, pointing out that I'd focused on Toss Girl, but the top female-ranked StarCraft player at the time was Scarlet. Scarlet is a trans woman, meaning that she has an XY chromosome. It's really not that hard to work out. Like outwardly visible physical attributes, there are real, quantifiable differences between male and female neurology and psychology. The problem is that behavioral motivations are much harder to quantify than hip-to-waist ratio. We know on a measurable, mathematical scale how men and women are expected to look, but how are they expected to behave? And as an even more abstract quandary, how do we expect society to collectively treat them? While I was working on my last video discussing the box office success of Titanic, I watched Logic's video, Idiot MRA Becomes Idiot Feminist, and I'm kind of two minds about it. Yeah, in the video, Logic covers an article written by a former MRA turned feminist, and a good portion of the time spent talking about men's rights activism is spent discussing a book called Spreading Misandry, and the way in which men are portrayed by the media and entertainment industry, the noticeable example in the article being Tim the Toolman Taylor from the 90s sitcom Home Improvement. On the one hand, I do agree with Logic to the extent that it's fucking stupid for special interest groups to complain that character X or perhaps even characters in general don't adequately paint their entire group identity in a perfect light. Yeah, it's not the job of writers to appease or progress your personal cause, whatever that may be. Black Lives Matter, LGBT, feminism, men's rights, fucking whatever. On the other hand, whilst I agree that it's frankly retarded to expect all these fictional characters to perfectly conform to a particular pre-approved stereotype that's been specially sanctioned and given a seal of approval by your personal identitarian movement, I also think that there is much to be learned by passively examining our taste in media consumption. I think an examination of the media and media portrayals can tell us a lot about our expectations of how men and women should be or perhaps are viewed and treated in the real world. Now, I'm not exactly sure what Logic's position on this is. His video was specifically addressing the fact that this guy claimed to previously be a men's rights activist, meaning that this guy was looking at these media portrayals of men like Tim the Toolman Taylor and then using those portrayals as the basis for some kind of actionable political cause. That's not really what I'm interested in doing here. I'm not an MRA and I've got no interest in trying to change the world. I'm certainly not interested in forcing the writers of sitcoms to change just to accommodate me. Description, not prescription, trademark, proprietary, limited. I just want to understand how the world works as accurately as possible. I really don't think these media portrayals actually spread misandry as our former MRA believed. But that doesn't mean that the proliferation of the oaf husband smart wife trope in sitcoms that he alluded to can't tell us anything meaningful about men and women, or at least our social expectations of male and female behaviour. You know, unless we're talking about some truly incomprehensible surrealist mindfuck like Mulholland Drive, characters and events tend to reflect the world as we commonly understand it. In a drama, if the characters or events stray too far from our expectations of reality, our suspension of disbelief is broken. In comedy, punchlines often work because they intentionally subvert our expectations of reality in a clever, understandable way. Breaking suspension of disbelief is basically what happens when our minds reject the body-swapped Bayonetta and Marcus Fenix. Our brains recognize on a visceral level that something isn't right, and it breaks our sense of immersion. Yeah, it's an easy thing to recognize with these video game caricatures. It's a little less obvious when it comes to a character's behavioral motivations, but it definitely does still happen. An example would be the film The Sweetest Thing, where Cameron Diaz and friends abruptly launch into an awkward, ill-timed musical number about penises.
Your penis is so strong. Your penis is so smooth.
Your penis got a rhythm.
Your penis makes me groove.
And you are suddenly and acutely aware that you are sitting on your couch trying not to cringe as you watch this childish, immature display of vulgarity unfold. Suspension of disbelief has been completely broken, not because they don't look like real people, but because the character's behavior is so uncomfortably awkward and completely out of place that you are taken out of the movie-going experience entirely. Compare this scene to the South Park episode Broadway Brodown, where Randy tries to write his own musical titled Splooge-Drenched Blowjob Queen, later renamed to The Woman in White thanks to the helpful input of Andrew Lloyd Webber. Here we see a very similar scenario of seemingly jarring, out-of-place musical numbers featuring overtly crass sexual subject matter, but it works. It works because in this case the audience is actually in on the joke. Like the penis song in Sweetest Things, it is an exercise in absurdity, but there is actually a real-world logical context behind the punchline which the audience understands. On some level, the audience knows that men probably only take their girlfriends on dates to see shitty Broadway musicals in the hopes of getting laid. The reason the South Park episode is so funny is because the subtext that everyone implicitly understands is being exaggerated and made explicitly overt. The juxtaposition of a Broadway musical actually breaking the fourth wall and singing subliminal commands to the female audience members about giving their boyfriends a blowjob for taking them to the show subverts the audience's expectations of reality in a humorous, understandable way. That mutual understanding on the part of the audience doesn't exist when three women just start randomly dancing around singing about dicks in the middle of a crowded cafe for absolutely no reason. Nothing meaningful or understandable has been subverted. It's just dumb and illogical and crass and awkward and lacking any real-world context. Whether it's drama or comedy, fictional stories and characters only make sense relative to our understanding of the world. As such, our collective tastes in media and entertainment are a reflection of ourselves and what we consider socially acceptable and correct. And I think by examining that, we can gain some insights into our general understanding of the world and our place therein. Getting back to the article which Logic covered, if Tim the Toolman or, say, Homer Simpson, Ray Barone, whoever, strayed too far from reality, or at least what we expect from the archetypical everyman these characters are meant to represent, we wouldn't understand their character motivations or get the intended punchlines of jokes. We would find it awkward, uncomfortable, and confusing to watch. The very fact that these shows are successful means that, unlike the penis song, there is some real-world basis underpinning these male characters, their behaviour, and the interactions they have with their wives, such that our suspension of disbelief isn't broken every time we see the oaf husband, smart wife trope play out. Like Bayonetta and Marcus Fenix, they are exaggerated caricatures, albeit behavioural caricatures rather than physical. But the point remains that they are behavioural caricatures we accept. Their motivations, actions, and interactions don't break our suspension of disbelief. In other words, yes, they are exaggerations, but they are exaggerations along a coherent spectrum of male-female behaviour that we innately understand. On some level, these characters do represent and reflect our underlying expectations of the archetypical middle-income husband and wife dynamic. Even in a sitcom like Big Bang Theory about a physicist who's married to a vapid, useless fucking waffle waitress, the woman apparently still knows best. The show makes it abundantly clear who is the dominant authority in that relationship. In fact, the punchline of that entire TV series is essentially that despite being a group of scientists who have worked on the Mars Rover Project and the International Space Station, when they all walk into a room full of strangers together, this completely useless, brain-dead waffle waitress is still immediately recognized as their social superior. This behavioral gender difference that underpins the relationship dynamic of sitcom couples is as real as the hip-to-waist ratio and muscle mass measurements which underpin physically exaggerated video game characters. Obviously, to a lesser extent than we see played out in these fictional sitcoms, on some real-world level, we really do expect husbands to just shut up and do whatever their wives tell them to. I really don't think that we as an audience would be quite as accepting and accommodating of these characters entering our living room each night if this representation of marriage dynamics which we see played out time and again as if on repeat wasn't a commonly held expectation in some real-world capacity. I mean, consider the fact that Homer Simpson is an engineer working at a nuclear power station, but we will still happily accept the show's narrative premise that he's such a fucking dumbass that it's literally a chore for his poor stay-at-home wife to even put up with him. Look, the existence of these characters are not really discriminatory against men. I don't think they are quote-unquote spreading misandry. I do, however, think that these recurring themes and the audience's comfortable and consistent acceptance of them does provide some insight into, shall we say, the underlying feature space of attitudes and behavioral expectations that we innately hold about male-female relationships. Now, the writer of the aforementioned MRA-turned-feminist article stated that Home Improvement was his most memorable example of misandry. To be honest, I think it's a pretty tame example considering what else is out there. The one that always immediately springs to my mind is American Horror Story, one episode in particular. In this episode, the female lead played by Sarah Paulson is trapped in Zachary Quinto's rape and murder dungeon. After managing to escape, she flags down a car that picks her up. The driver almost immediately flies into an irate rant about how much he hates women, especially his cheating ex-wife, ultimately ending the rant by putting a .38 in his mouth and blowing his own brains out while they're still travelling along at 60 miles an hour. Yeah, this is literally the first guy that she randomly runs into immediately after escaping from a serial killer's rape dungeon. What does this show say about men? I'm not offended by this. I don't think the show should be rewritten to appease my personal opinions. But it does tell me something. At the very least, it tells me something about the personal opinions of series creator Ryan Murphy. Yes, the same Ryan Murphy also responsible for Glee. Now, you could probably do an entire series of videos about the problems in Glee. Clearly, this guy has some very deep-seated and unresolved issues surrounding straight white men. But for our purposes, I just want to focus on two peripherally connected story arcs from season 3. The first is about the female football coach Beast being beaten on by her husband, where we get this heartfelt speech directed at all the female members of the Glee Club about how it's never okay for a man to hit them.
I didn't get hit by a punching bag. I got hit by my husband.
Are you serious?
And I heard you girls say that you thought your boyfriends would never do anything to you like that. And a week ago, I would have said exactly the same thing. And I was wrong.
The second story arc involves Finn getting hit in the face by an irate Santana Lopez.
What are you talking about?
I cannot even begin to imagine the shitstorm that would have befallen Finn had he been the one to angrily punch Santana in the face in front of everyone, but this story arc ultimately resolves without her even getting a cursory slap on the wrist because Finn, being the blue pill white knighting simp that he is, lies and claims that the physical assault which everyone witnessed was only a stage slap.
What is it called in a play or a movie when you pretend to hit someone but you don't?
A stage slap?
It was a stage slap. That's what it was.
This show clearly presents a double standard on the social acceptability of physical violence between the genders. The obvious stock response here would be that Ryan Murphy is just one guy, and the fact that he's got a rather nasty anti-male streak in him really doesn't prove anything. And I guess in a cultural vacuum that would be true, but Glee and American Horror Story don't exist in a vacuum, and I think the audience's reaction to these story arcs can provide insights beyond Ryan Murphy's personal problems and into the broader social attitudes of what we think is acceptable treatment for men and women. In his recap review for Huffington Post, Joey DeAngelis opened saying that this was one of the more grounded and moving episodes of American Horror Story. Well, now that's just two guys. Still doesn't prove anything, right? On Rotten Tomatoes, the episode holds a 90% fresh rating based on 10 reviews, and it seems that the one negative review was because the episode had too much gore, not enough camp. 10 people and not even a passing mention about the show's generally negative portrayal of men. Apparently, the episode was watched by almost 2 million live viewers. Contrast all this with the fact that you can't even sneeze in the general direction of a fictional female action hero like Mystique these days without someone, somewhere getting triggered. 1, 2, 10, 2 million. I guess the question is, at what point is the threshold crossed where we can reasonably conclude that within this constantly triggered social justice culture of outrage and offence, even where there shouldn't reasonably be any, Ryan Murphy's fictional depiction of men as crazed, violent misogynists seems to be broadly socially acceptable? I mean, Ryan Murphy as an individual certainly seems to hold a clear disdain for straight white men. And to the extent that everyone else doesn't hold that same disdain, they certainly don't seem too interested in calling Murphy out on it, like they do every time some supermarket CEO who you've never even heard of makes a vague comment about white men having to work harder to keep up with quotas. With the near constant level of outrage and offence over the depiction of female characters, I think we can safely say that this kind of extreme negative portrayal of men is at the very least broadly seen as a social non-issue by comparison. I think this double standard of social outrage segues perfectly into the issue of video games. I've been playing first-person shooters since the mid-90s. I couldn't even guess at the sheer number of men I've virtually killed over the years. Virtual violence against men is perfectly fine, it seems. Apart from a few conservative Jack Thompson types, this kind of quote-unquote virtual murder simulation is perfectly socially sanctioned and acceptable. Enter Grand Theft Auto. As soon as that virtual violence could be directed towards the other gender as well, we found ourselves quickly mired in controversy. Some lady starts a change.org petition claiming that GTA 5 promotes violence against women. Within days, that petition has 40,000 signatures. Within the week, Target Australia has taken the game off their shelves. I mean, you can hire a prostitute and then murder her to get your money back. That's just awful. Well, let's compare GTA 5 to Far Cry 4, where I can go up to one of the Sherpas, sell him all of my shit, and then once the transaction is complete, I can murder him and steal his inventory. Where's the fucking outrage? Even though from an ethical standpoint, it's basically the exact same scenario where the player has the ability to violently renege on an agreed transaction, the Sherpa doesn't represent a male-female interaction, and that is a big difference in the eyes of the general public. There are still a lot of games on the shelf at Target that allow you to explore the act of being a psychotic, violent asshole within the confines of a safe virtual environment. And that's perfectly fine. It only becomes a problem when you have the option of being a psychotic, violent asshole to a virtual woman. And the social justice concerns over GTA didn't simply stop with the prostitution controversy. I mean, you could make an entire video addressing the concern trolling by the pro-feminist gaming press surrounding this title, particularly the stupidity of people like Jim Sterling, who decried the supposed sexism and misogyny of GTA, and then in the very same breath argued that it should have aimed to be more inclusive like Saints Row 4. Yeah, good old Jim, whose yardstick for inclusivity and non-sexist is apparently a game that has an ass-raping dildo stick as a melee weapon. But I digress. There was such a fixation on the poor, helpless womenfolk being virtually degraded by this game that nobody stopped to ask the glaringly obvious question, okay, so how then are men depicted in GTA? The three main playable characters are a wannabe gangbanger, a fucked up, burned out, retired old mafioso whose own family hates him, and a straight up homicidal redneck psychopath with deep-seated mummy issues. Certainly not pleasant people at all. So, what does this game say about men? Well, I don't think it says much at all, really, about men or about women. It seems to me that every single character in that entire game, from the three playable leads to the main story characters, all the way down to the NPCs in the side missions, all of them, each and every single one, regardless of gender, race, age, nationality, whatever, were all equally depicted as completely deplorable, self-serving, nasty, low-life scumbags. To the extent that you could level any moralistic accusation against GTA, you could perhaps say that the game is misanthropic, but not explicitly sexist, at least not by any reasonable definition of showing prejudice towards one gender over the other. I also want to briefly consider Peter's ongoing protests about the depiction of virtual dogs in games like Call of Duty and Wolfenstein. The subtext being that your virtual murder of men in these games is perfectly fine, just don't go hurting any virtual animals in the process. Now, Peter are legitimately crazy as fuck, so I don't know how far you could reasonably stretch their relevance on this issue, but it is still an example that in some very rare and extreme cases, fictional depictions of violence against men are seen as being even less of a social concern than non-humans. I mean, granted, most people don't really like or agree with Peter, but the fact is you're probably still more likely to see a mainstream news story like this about the representation of violence against animals in video games than violence against men. The closest you're likely to get is something like Hatred, where critics have complained that it generally promotes indiscriminate violence against everyone, rather than any commentary explicitly addressing virtual violence against men. I know Barbarossa has spoken about the concept of virtual morality before, and from a purely philosophical standpoint, I do agree with him. Morality does not exist within a virtual simulation. From a pragmatic standpoint, however, these virtual simulators themselves do exist in the real world where morality does exist. And as a result, there are still limitations imposed on what we broadly consider socially acceptable mainstream products that are sold in our real world marketplace. Video games are really amazing. They let you do things that you could never do in the real world, whether that's driving a car that you could never afford, or walking down the street punching random strangers in the back of the head with brass knuckles. Despite the freedom within that virtual space, however, it's interesting to consider what external limitations we still socially impose on the design and creation of these virtual spaces. In basically every open world game, Far Cry, Watch Dogs, Just Cause, Fallout, and even GTA, children are conspicuously absent from the virtual world. Even though these products are virtual simulations where no harm actually befalls anyone, the mainstream exploration of child murder is not something that we're really prepared to accept and indulge in as a society. Now, it's a little less conspicuous than the issue of children, but given the widespread reactions to a game like GTA, there is also clearly a difference in what we consider socially acceptable when it comes to video game depictions of adult men and women. Despite all the talk of equal representation, there are still invisible lines that can be crossed when it comes to treatment of the fairer sex, even if that treatment is in a completely harmless virtual simulation. To the extent that a company like Rockstar has gotten away with it, it's still seen as very taboo, and they didn't get away without incurring substantial public criticism. Like American Horror Story, whilst I don't think these fictional characters themselves really tell us anything, I think the audience's reaction can reveal a great deal. This is a game that depicted everyone equally poorly. This is a game that explores the sheer depths of human detritus and depravity, the vast majority of which is actually perpetrated against virtual men in the game. Yet, in a game centered around a good-for-nothing, violent gangster being reunited with his psychotic, serial killer best friend, who over the course of the story murder their way through countless other men to get what they want, it's ultimately the female side characters of a spoilt daughter and a remorseless cheating wife that gets everyone's collective panties in a twist. You know, what does this character say about women? What does this game say about men? These are ultimately the wrong questions to be asking, and it's why I don't think that the self-serving identitarian complaints of feminists like Anita Sarkeesian and MRAs like the fellow from Logic's video are particularly helpful. The real question is, what does it say about people's general innate behavioural attitudes towards men and women that they can look at a dark, cynical game like Grand Theft Auto, which portrays literally everyone in a negative light, but only interpret this general misanthropy as being one-sided misogynistic sexism specifically against women? Ultimately, people don't consider men and women social equals. If you're equally critical of everyone, like we see in GTA, that position is going to be interpreted as explicitly sexist against women. In a not-so-bizarre twist of irony, equal treatment is actually seen as unequal. Now, most of the focus thus far has been on physical violence, although GTA did peripherally touch on sexuality in terms of the prostitution controversy. However, when we actually look at some specific examples of male sexuality in fiction, the differing standards between behavioural expectations and social acceptability for men and women is even more stark. I have yet to see a major Hollywood comedy release where a fat chick gets violently dildo-raped in a Vegas hotel room by a drunk male stripper, and we're expected to find the scene hilarious, as we are with Jonah Hill's character in Getting to the Greek.
Stop! No!
Like,
I want to go home!
This is going inside of you!
Get off of me!
What are you doing?
Oh my god!
Now, I want to make it quite clear here that I actually don't have a problem with this scene at all. You know, I'm not some triggered little bitch actively looking for things to get offended about on behalf of all men, like those chumps over on Return of Kings who wanted to boycott Fury Road. Honestly, I fucking loved Getting to the Greek. It's goddamn hilarious. But it remains a perfect example to highlight how men and women are viewed differently and the double standard of what we consider socially acceptable portrayals and treatment of them. I mean, can you even imagine that rape scene unfolding in the middle of a similarly toned female-oriented comedy like Bridesmaids? You know, they're all a little drunk at the bachelorette party, they're singing bad karaoke, Kristen Wiig says something stupid, and then a male stripper drags Melissa McCarthy off to the bedroom, holds her down, and starts fucking her against her will while she cries, "No, stop, what are you doing?" Hilarious, right? There is literally no condition under which that shit would ever fly if the genders were reversed. Because, you know, rape jokes are never funny. Unless they're at the expense of men. I mean, Jesus Christ, man, this isn't even the only big-budget Hollywood comedy film that Jonah Hill gets graphically raped in.
This is no dream. This is really happening.
And if you're prepared to look deeper than Hollywood's mainstream, it gets even more blatant. Case in point, Rob Schneider's film Big Stan, which should have simply been titled Rape.
I'd probably rape you.
You'd rape me?
Rape
by Nazis?
Rape.
Do you just want somebody to...
Yeah. Now, if you're to believe Schneider's defense, he claims he intended the film to be a statement against male rape. Personally, I don't really buy it, but even if you do believe that he had the best intentions making this film, the best that you could say is that he failed miserably. It is nothing more than an hour and a half of shameless, non-stop rape jokes at the expense of male prisoners. This was not a mainstream film. This was not a financially successful film, but it was still a film that got made by a notable comedian. And you know that wouldn't happen if it was 1.5 hours of women getting raped. Assuming that Schneider could have even gotten that film made, he probably would have ended up being murdered by a feminist lynch mob before the film's premiere. I mean, hell, Daniel Tosh only had to have one slip up against a female heckler in the middle of a live show to put a permanent black mark on his comedy career. In fact, we don't even need to get as explicit as "wouldn't it be funny if that girl got raped by like 5 guys right now?" There's some demonstration of a fighting game at E3. The girl who's getting her ass kicked starts complaining that she can't block and her competitor is too fast, to which he responds with some smug, competitive trash talk that she should just let it happen and it'll be over soon. The audience laughed at the remark, but many have interpreted it as a rape joke. Oh, how awful. So awful, apparently, that it had to be covered by every fucking news outlet. All of these issues are constantly framed by people from both sides as being part of some larger culture war that needs to be fought and won. This, I think, is a mistake. I just haven't quite worked out yet whether it's an intentional mistake, because this culture war is really starting to feel like our very own version of the perpetual war in Orwell's 1984. Quick everyone, look at what the Wall Street Journal's doing. We need to fight back. A children's book where Black Santa marries his gay husband, that'll show those racist homophobes. Oh, the regressive left is blocking people on Twitter. Personal pronouns like he and she are problematic. I mean, consider the fact that everyone knows a debate is not about convincing your opponent, but winning over the undecided minds in the middle. That being the case, I have to ask, apart from view counts, what is actually gained by anyone when two YouTubers with devout subscription audiences have a debate and then go back to their respective little corners of the internet to proclaim that they pwned the other guy? Then, you know, out of the blue, someone gets punched in the face and suddenly the alliances all shift again, reminiscent of Oceania always being at war with East Asia. You know, Big Brother needs your Patreon money to fight the good fight. No ground is ever actually lost or gained, but everyone feels like they're making progress against their ideological enemies. It's all illusionary. There is no real culture war going on, there is just culture. And that culture is ultimately reflective of our underlying biology and psychology. I've mentioned this in older videos, but this is exactly why Gamergate failed. Gamergate tried to hold people like Anita Sarkeesian and Zoe Quinn accountable for their actions and their stated positions. But the fact is that according to the rules of this reproductive game that we've dressed up and called civilization, having a vagina trumps having sound logical arguments. It doesn't matter how stupid or hypocritical or cringeworthy they are. Pretty feminists need only cry misogyny and harassment, and all of your criticism, no matter how thoughtful or correct, is immediately invalidated. Gamergate lost because they made the mistake of bringing a cultural knife to a biological gunfight. They never stood a chance because, as Sun Tzu would say, they didn't know their enemy. Yeah, feminists are fraudulent hypocrites, you say? Well, that's nice, but when all the smoke has cleared from this supposedly intellectual battlefield, who are the ones actually addressing the United Nations on matters of internet harassment? And this is why I think this so-called culture war we see happening across the internet right now is so similar to the Forever War in 1984, which, as alluded to in the book, may not have even been happening at all, but served the practical purpose of maintaining the proles' nationalistic support in the party. The only thing that Gamergate actually achieved was to grow the subscriber numbers and Patreon accounts, you know, the, shall we say, vested interests of certain individuals. Speaking of people who struck internet gold during the failed revolution that was Gamergate, I cannot think of a better example to highlight what it really means getting embroiled in this perpetual culture war than the infamous livestream where Sargon told Stardust that even though gynocentrism is a real thing, we shouldn't talk about it because it's quote-unquote bad for PR.
Okay, that's true. That's all completely true. And you're right, it is the innate desire of men to cater to women that is leading to them getting lower prison sentences and all this sort of stuff.
Right.
And you know, and family, completely biased family courts.
And I don't know if we can fix it, you know, well, but the awareness is important.
But, and you're right. However, gynocentrism, talking from like a PR perspective, is not the right word.
And instead, we should discuss these gender differences in terms of egalitarianism.
You know, people are turned off by it. Okay?
Yeah. But I mean,
it's technically accurate though. But I think I think there might be a better way of phrasing it, and I think the way to phrase it would be anti-egalitarian.
Well, I'm sorry, but egalitarianism has no power to explain the reproductive dynamic between men and women. Egalitarianism is an ideological and legal concept that has only practically existed in a handful of Western industrialized nations for about the last 50 years or so. It cannot even begin to explain the psychology behind a man going off to die in World War I because some bitch he'd never even met handed him a white feather. You cannot examine and explain the deep underlying reproductive behaviors we're concerned with through the lens of a recent Western political ideology. This is really the problem with all of these so-called pop culture critics and social commentators who are largely driven by some kind of personal identitarian agenda. They all claim to have the ideological fix for whatever culturally ails you. Whether it's our former MRA friend from the Logicked video complaining about Tim the Toolman spreading misandry, or it's Anita Sarkeesian decrying the fact that Mario enforces harmful gender stereotypes. It's a bizarre paradox, but when you think about it, even those claiming to fight cultural Marxism are by definition social constructivists themselves. Yeah, you know, if they do truly believe that a 50-page manifesto from 150 years ago, which no one's ever even read, is really to blame for all of the problems in our modern world. MRAs, feminists, anti-Marxists, they all seem to be working from this bizarre top-down premise that our media somehow drives the real world, rather than our real world inspiring and informing those media representations of ourselves from the bottom up. I mean, Anita Sarkeesian isn't factually wrong about the damsel in distress trope. That is ultimately the plot of Mario. Plot is in scare quotes, obviously. The problem with Sarkeesian is really not her factual observations about narrative cliches, but that the social constructivist conclusions she draws don't logically follow from those facts. Mario doesn't enforce gender stereotypes, it is simply informed by them. Once you take out all the trippy shit like talking turtles and walking mushrooms, what you are essentially left with is a woman. A princess. Literal fucking royalty who gets herself into trouble, and then it's up to some poor, working class plumber who's expected to risk his life trying to save the bitch. To the extent that you can argue Mario even has a narrative, it's not an inaccurate representation of male disposability and white knighting for women who are ultimately considered well above your social station, all in the hopes of future reproductive access, or in Mario's case, future access to cake. Much like the calculated attempt by Sargon to moderate real constructive thought by insisting we lock ourselves into a PR-friendly ideological framework like egalitarianism, Anita Sarkeesian's feminism might help to keep the cultural war machine rolling and the Patreon numbers up, but it is a completely inadequate mechanism to shed any meaningful insight on the underlying reasons behind even the simple video game goals of Mario. Now, this allusion to male disposability isn't to say that MRAs instead of feminists should be the ones pissed off at Mario. The point is that nobody should really be pissed off at Mario. To the extent that Mario is based on a trope or a gender stereotype, that trope ultimately exists because that is the way our real human reproductive biology ultimately exists. Mario is a disposable white knight for his high-status potential mate. Well, guess what? Most men are disposable white knights for their high-status potential mates. And most women, even the feminist women, like it this way. You know, logically, Mario should really be the he-for-she poster boy. Here is the bottom line about this kind of bullshit, where subjects that have real biological underpinnings are turned into yet another battlefield in the ongoing culture war of insert current year. Mario does not exist because of some institutional patriarchy. Mario exists the way he does for exactly the same reason that guys get themselves shot, sticking their noses into other people's domestic affairs out of a misguided desire to try and save women they've never even met. Mario exists the way he does for the same reason that if a woman hits a man and he dares retaliate, a horde of thugs will descend and beat the ever-living shit out of him. Mario exists the way he does for the same reason that sniveling male feminists like Jonathan McIntosh and David Futrell will get online to debase themselves and their entire gender in the hopes that one of their feminist princesses will pat them on the head for being a good man. Mario exists for the same reason that these very same feminists who hate on men will expect men to save them when they get into trouble. Mario exists the way he does for the same reason that so many men never made it off the Titanic alive and why no women were sent against their will to the Vietnam War. Mario exists the way he does for the same reason that some thug will beat the shit out of a guy for being rude to his girlfriend after she tries to cut in line at a pizzeria. Trope has basically become a negative way of saying that something is a recurring motif. But there are clear, obvious reasons why these things become recurring motifs in the first place. As I mentioned at the start of this video, there is a real-world logic that even underpins South Park jokes. There has to be, otherwise we wouldn't understand the punchlines. Like it or not, there is actually a real, biological, reproductive logic which underpins this very simple video game goal of rescue the princess. The very reason this narrative trope exists is because it's the same biological, reproductive logic that also underpins so many other aspects of male-female dynamics and goals in the real world. The reproductive goal underlying Mario is really no more sexist than the mathematically exaggerated bodies of Marcus Fenix and Bayonetta. The low-status male risking his life to protect the high-status potential mate is exactly what we'd expect to see when male-female relationships are reduced to their most basic components and turned into a video game goal. Mario is a simplified behavioral caricature that represents real-world reproductive access. Changing Mario to accommodate high-minded ideological ideals about egalitarianism, feminism, men's rights activism, or whateverism isn't going to improve real-world gender equality for men or women. It's just going to make a surreal children's game even less grounded in the real-world reproductive reality that we all know actually exists. I mean, whatever side you're on, that's ultimately the theoretical win state of this never-ending culture war. It's not going to change the world and save marriage, stop the patriarchy, or encourage widespread empathy for men. It's just going to make Mario a shit game that people don't want to play because simple character motivations will no longer make sense in terms of our real reproductive biology. I remember Mundane Matt covering this post years ago back when he had the original blue skull head in a video titled In Defense of Guybrush Threepwood. Now, you may have read this post before, but I think it's worth reading again because it touches directly on the underlying problem here. Quote, "Do you know why there are so many white male characters in video games, especially leads? Because no one cares about them. A white male can be a lecherous drunk, a woman can't, or it's sexist, sexualizing women and what all. A white male can be a mentally disturbed soldier whose mind is unraveling as he walks through the modern battlefield. A woman can't, or you're victimizing women and saying they're all crazy. Consider Guybrush Threepwood, star of the Monkey Island series. He's weak, socially awkward, cowardly, kind of a nerd, and generally the last person you'd think of to even cabin boy on a pirate ship, let alone captain one. He is abused, verbally and physically, mistreated, shunned, hated, and generally made to feel unwelcome. Now let's say Guybrush was a girl. We'll call her Galbrush. Galbrush is socially awkward, cowardly, kind of a nerd, and generally the last person you'd think of to even cabin girl on a pirate ship, let alone captain one. She is abused, verbally and physically, mistreated, shunned, hated, and generally made to feel unwelcome." Now, you might notice that I've given the exact same description to both of these characters, but here's where things deviate. While no one cares if Guybrush takes a pounding for being, for lack of a better term, a less than ideal pirate, Galbrush will be presumed to be discriminated against because of her gender. In fact, every hardship she will endure, though exactly the same as the hardships Guybrush endured, will be considered misogyny rather than someone simply being ill-suited to their desired calling. And that ending, she goes through all of that trouble to help, let's call him Eli Marley, escape the evil clutches of the ghost pirateess LeChuck. It turns out he didn't even need her help, and she even screwed up his plans to thwart LeChuck. Why, it'd be a slap in the face to every woman who's ever picked up a controller. Not only is the protagonist inept, but apparently women make lousy villains too. And that is why Guybrush exists and Galbrush doesn't. Men can be comically inept halfwits, women can't. Men can be flawed, tragic human beings, women can't. And why? Because every single female character reflects all women everywhere. End quote. Like I said, there is no culture war, there is just culture. Ideologues fighting over whether this or that is an appropriate fictional representation according to insert identitarian agenda here is a big old waste of everyone's fucking time. The fact that Guybrush exists instead of Galbrush doesn't prove patriarchy, and the abusive slapstick comedy reasons behind this gender choice doesn't spread misandry either. It just means that there are real, underlying biological reasons behind these narrative gender choices which otherwise wouldn't make sense to our evolved human brains. Galbrush would be perceived as an awkward, out-of-place mess like Cameron Diaz singing the penis song. Like the original post itself, you can come up with all kinds of perfectly reasonable, intellectual, rational explanations for why that is. But the simplest, most reductive explanation is that our brains would simply reject this female Galbrush character because, like Bayonetta and Marcus Fenix having their physical body type swapped, Galbrush strays too far from the realities of real gender dimorphic behavior and social treatment that we all know and understand. on a real, visceral level, people just don't like seeing women get knocked around, abused, and mistreated. Whether you like it or not, men, however, are reproductively disposable, so the male Guybrush serves as an appropriate vehicle to tell Monkey Island's depressing, ironic slapstick story of a hapless, incompetent loser. The insistent framing of these issues as being part of a culture war is a misdirection, because these things like Mario and Monkey Island and Home Improvement and Glee and GTA do not represent problems happening at the cultural level. Yeah, assuming they're even problems at all, they're happening at the biological reproductive level. The culture war. This is not a cultural conflict. This is a biological conflict. The culture that we see is just the visible outward expression of that biological conflict. Think about it like this. Culture is just the shadow that our biology casts. Fighting over these biological gender issues as aspects of some larger culture war is ultimately like Peter Pan fighting his own shadow. You can't adequately address these things by simply shouting anti-egalitarian or patriarchy or misandry. Yes, the oaf husband, smart wife trope is prolific. This depiction of marriage dynamics in sitcoms is prolific for the very same reason that every married guy I know gives me this depressed half smile and says, "Happy wife, happy life," when telling me all the things he's not allowed to do. It's prolific for the same reason that mansplaining has been accepted into the Oxford English Dictionary. It's prolific for the same reason that we see so many "Where Have All the Good Men Gone" articles. It's prolific for the same reason that over 2/3 of all divorces are initiated by women, and one of the most common reasons cited is that they're just bored with their partner. It's prolific for the same reason that when women start earning the lion's share of the household income, or the husband becomes the stay-at-home parent, the divorce rate skyrockets. Regardless of their measurable contributions, if any, women are collectively perceived as being more socially valuable than men. This innate gender bias is simply reflected in our sitcoms. Yes, Glee and American Horror Story do paint a one-sided view of gender violence. They present this view for the exact same reason that primary aggressor laws like VAWA exist. They present this view for the same reason that White Ribbon and Take Back the Night campaigns exist. They present this view for the same reason that over 30% of American women live in constant fear of sexual assault. They present this view for the same reason that the 1 in 5 statistic won't go away despite the completely fraudulent research behind it. They present this view for the same reason that our former Governor General has recommended we create kangaroo courts to specially handle domestic violence accusations, and it appears that the government is going to go through with it. They present this view for the same reason that despite Title IX, American universities are implementing their own extrajudicial kangaroo courts. They present this view for the same reason that women get lighter sentences for the same crimes. They present this view for the same reason that some people are arguing women should not go to jail for their crimes, period. Regardless of what they've actually done. Regardless of the facts, we perceive women as default victims and men as default perpetrators. This innate gender bias is simply reflected in our dramas. Yes, people have perceived the ubiquitous equal opportunity misanthropy of GTA as being one-sided sexist misogyny explicitly designed to degrade women. They perceive this for the same reason that the thoroughly debunked notions of the gender pay gap still persist. They perceive this for the same reason that most affirmative action programs are still aimed at women, even though they're now 65% of university admissions. They perceive this for the same reason that women can sue a workplace for discrimination, even though they are literally incapable of fulfilling the basic job requirements. They perceive this for the same reason that we still hear about institutional barriers to women in STEM, despite clear evidence of a 2-to-1 hiring bias in their favour. They perceive this for the same reason that the Bechdel test is gaining traction, even though it says nothing about whether a film or its female characters are actually good. They perceive this for the same reason that the EU wants to force 40% female quotas on company boards by 2020. They perceive this for the same reason that we constantly hear complaints about sexism, that women's sport doesn't receive the same attention and sponsorship as male sports, despite the fact that the top female soccer team in the world just lost 5-2 to a team of under 15 schoolboys. When women are treated equally, or more accurately held to the same equal standards and expectations as men, we see it as unequal and unfair. This gender bias is simply reflected in our perception of video games. Yes, getting to the Greek and Big Stan make light of male rape in ways that would never, ever be acceptable if the genders were reversed. This double standard exists for the same reason that rape laws, despite claiming to be non-gender specific, are written to explicitly include penetration in the definition, therefore making it legally impossible for a woman to rape a man. This double standard exists for the same reason that rape shield laws exist, to subvert due process and ensure that the woman always has the final say on any contested matters of sexual misconduct. This double standard exists for the same reason that when a Russian man is held captive for days while he's tortured and raped by a woman, everyone jokes that he secretly must have enjoyed it. This double standard exists for the same reason that in Canada, a man cannot sue his ex for lying about taking the pill, but if a man pokes holes in a condom, it's rape due to the woman's lack of informed consent. This double standard exists for the same reason that in France, a man can literally be sued thousands of dollars in damages for not having enough sex with his wife. But, you know, we have to put a stop to all of these evil, sexually entitled nice guys. This double standard exists for the same reason that it's become an almost weekly occurrence for us to hear a news story about some female paedophile who's gotten off with nothing more than a slap on the wrist. This double standard exists for the same reason that a male victim of statutory rape is actually ordered by the court to pay child support to his female paedophile rapist. This double standard exists for the same reason that Mattress Girl can be exposed for making the whole thing up and still get an award for bravery by the National Organization of Women. This double standard exists for exactly the same reason that the majority of rapes in the US are actually perpetrated against men in the prison system, but nothing is ever done. We see sexuality and reproduction as being exclusively owned by women. And ultimately, you can't steal or take away from men what they never owned in the first place. This innate gender bias is simply reflected in our comedy movies. I want you to consider all of the things that we've just looked at, and now consider the famous words of feminist darling Chloe Agnew.
Age. Before I say anything else, I have to thank you, Sabrina, for writing this. I think you've done a tremendous act of public service, and I'm genuinely very, very grateful.
Thank you.
It is hard to read an article like this and avoid the conclusion that we live in a culture that hates women, just hates us. It's hard to read an article like this and conclude that the men in this culture, boys and men in this culture, are raised to see women as not just less than them, but in some cases as less than human.
Notwithstanding the fact that the article she's thanking Sabrina Erdley for writing turned out to be such a fucking fraudulent piece of shit that Rolling Stone magazine ultimately had to retract it, and both the magazine and author are now in the process of being sued by just about everyone involved, what young Miss Agnew has presented is still the socially sanctioned, mainstream status quo position. even when literally proven fraudulent. Just like Gamergate, the facts are completely irrelevant to the continuation of to poor oppressed women's narrative. It really doesn't matter that high-profile cases like Mattress Girl or Rolling Stone's A Rape on Campus article turn out to be complete and utter fabrications. And it doesn't matter that all of the media we've just looked at tells the complete opposite story about who society apparently just hates. The very fact that this mainstream narrative even exists in the first place, the very fact that it continues to persist in spite of all the clear evidence to the contrary, speaks to a much bigger problem surrounding human gender relations than some vague cultural bias in our media. Do I think feminism's assessment of society and their theories about a systemic, institutionalized patriarchy are inaccurate? Yes. Do I think, contrary to the mainstream narrative, that these media properties actually reflect a rather shit deal for men, socially speaking? Yes. But I don't think any of these media portrayals actually spread misandry. All they do is accurately reflect our innate, real-world attitudes about men and women. Attitudes that are firmly grounded within our sexually dimorphic reproductive biology. Biology that is ultimately well and truly outside the scope of any internet culture water change.